there's so much nepotism as well within the industry. And I think one of the things that everyone needs to look at is the first change I saw that we made was around showing salaries on our job ads. There's so much research that women and people from ethnic minority backgrounds sell themselves short.
Welcome back to Media Voices, everybody. We are the B2B media focused podcast that takes a look at absolutely everything to do with the media, from business models all the way down to the ethical concerns that underpin them. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston. And that clip you just heard was from my interview with Riddhi Radia, head of ED&I at Immediate Media. Well, these conversations are always weird for me. I am obviously of a certain demographic, and I always feel like, I'm a weird person to be asking these questions. But one of the things that Riddhi and I spoke about was the fact she was encouraged that people like me were actually talking about this. So that was good. We talked about how important it is to embed values of inclusion in the workplace, within organizational leadership particularly, but also what she was doing at Immediate, helping networks of underrepresented groups come together to create change. It was fun. It was a good conversation.
It was. And having edited it, I can confirm that you did bring up quite a few times the fact that you are a cis straight white man within the media industry. So yeah. And if you want to stay up to speed with absolutely everything that's going on with Media Voices, why not sign up to our daily newsletter? Now, you can get that by going to voices.media and signing up. While you're there, you may as well sign up to our community forum as well, where we're having chats about every single aspect of the media. This week, our discussion is all about subscriptions and, more importantly, consumers' attitude to subscription products. So Toolkits, who you should be subscribed to, by the way, conducted a study in partnership with the research and insights firm National Research Group into US consumer attitudes to publishers' digital subscription products. Now, this isn't just all about Spotify, Netflix.
No, this is specifically publishers' digital subscriptions.
Then that explains some of the bizarre facts that are contained within it. So there's a weird mix, I think, of good, bad, and ugly in here. So 85% of subscribers to digital publications reported being completely or mostly satisfied with the value for money they receive from their subscriptions, which is actually up slightly from 75% in August of 2022. However, 12% reported being somewhat satisfied, while just 3% said they were mostly satisfied or not at all satisfied. So that's good news, right? Everybody in news is doing incredibly well, and everybody who's paying is incredibly satisfied.
Yeah. Well, some of these people are actually former subscribers.
And we can talk about, why people have quit their subscriptions further down. The proportion of consumers who subscribe to at least one digital publication that they did not visit at least once a month dropped to 27% from 46% in 2022. That's a huge fall. So is that a lingering hangover of the pandemic when people were just throwing money at whatever?
I think that's a cost of living thing, that people have actually done audits on the stuff that they don't use.
Yeah.
That is a huge fall. And I think that's because that whole thing of, I subscribed 9 years ago and can't remember. That's a true story, actually. Johnson the Cleaner still takes.
I have subscribed going out to Ionos every month, and I don't know what they're doing for me. But I'm afraid that if I take it away, my entire digital empire will crumble.
Yeah. Is it entirely that, though? Is there likely to be that sort of after the pandemic, there were an awful lot of publishers, as they adopted the subscription models, that did quite a lot of sort of onboarding and offers and things to get people in. And I suppose now that people sort of be a bit more discerning, because there's another finding in this that almost a third of subscribers to digital publications have actually increased the number they've had in the last 12 months. So it's almost like, well, they might be ditching the ones that they're not visiting and ditching the ones they're not engaging with, but it's not a case that they're sort of, they had 10 subscriptions, they're cancelling a bunch of them. They are actually increasing the number they have. They're just being savvier about what they spend their money on. And if they don't visit frequently, which from a publisher's point of view, that's a really good metric to start looking at in terms of retention rates. It's just being more discerning about where they're spending the money, not necessarily spending less of it.
Mm. I always think back to, there was a stat that, I don't know whether this is even still ringing true, but definitely in about 2019, there was research that showed that people have four main subscriptions: two entertainment, one generalist news and one specialist news, you know, hobbyist news or something like much more specific to them. I'm wondering how much that has changed since then, because if I think about the number of entertainment subscriptions I have versus the number of news subscriptions, it is so vastly different than it was back in 2019, purely because there's more services, I suppose, in the entertainment space, but also because the amount of news I consume has changed.
Insidious. It's like, we still pay for Paramount because of Yellow Jackets. What the hell?
Even after it went downhill in second season.
Well, when was the last episode? I don't think we've even watched the last episode in the second season. Yeah. Point is, we're still paying for it.
You're still paying for Christina Ricci.
What I was going to say about the satisfaction thing is, I think a lot of people, you know, when the advertising sort of collapse began a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, whatever it was, a lot of people rushed out subscription products. And I don't think the user experience was necessarily brilliant. You know, people didn't have onboarding sorted. They didn't have the whole journey. And I think publishers are probably getting better at that because they've been doing it a bit longer and they're
dropping their paywall.
Paying more attention.
Yeah. It's actually interesting to put this in context of the fact that we, I mean, just last week we were talking about, you know, people moving away from hard paywalls to this kind of wider mix, but that feeds very neatly into our next stat. So Esther, what leapt out at you about this next advertising stat? Because I find it fascinating.
Yeah, I find this really interesting. So subscribers who weren't fully satisfied with the value for money they received from publishers' subscription products, ad load was actually cited as one of the key reasons. And I know we discussed this with Charlotte Henry in the Media Moments episode we did at the end of last year. With broadcast, with Amazon and Disney Plus and things, sort of saying, okay, well, you can pay as a subscriber and also going to introduce ads. That it seems to sort of was, and Charlotte's written a great piece about this, it's sort of broken that contract, that sort of unspoken contract that subscribers feel like they had. That's like, okay, if I pay you, I expect at the very least an ad light experience, you know, with minimal, if not no advertising. Given the pressures many publishers are under, they'll just be like, well, it's, and this sort of reason, especially if you're a logged in user, you're a logged in subscriber, they know quite a lot about you, are an incredibly valuable person to them to sell advertising to as well as a subscription. And I think we're kind of heading for a bit of a reckoning on some of this. Because that's, if that site is the top reason for dissatisfaction, you might get people who love the publication, haven't cancelled, but it's... That's what Brian Morris was writing about, the mayo sandwich thing. How much mayo can you put on the sandwich before somebody's like, yeah, no?
It's a weird one though, right? Because if you think back to the bad old days of print, subscribers were given ads, right? It was the same one you got on the newsstand most of the time, and it was the same ads. And it's a balance thing. Well, I guess you can be Vogue, but their ads are part of the content, right?
That, well, certainly in print they were. I'm not sure if that confers the same benefit digitally.
I mean, Mark Alcott actually did a really interesting piece in publishing a couple of weeks ago where he'd taken Single Track World and he'd actually reduced the number of ads they'd had and the revenue remained consistent, if not went up slightly. And he just said, like, if you just cut out all of that, you know, the page experience is better. You're more likely to see and notice the ad on the page rather than the sort of multitude which you just end up blurring out. I don't understand why Reach don't like look at that and think.
Oh, let's not start on Reach again.
I know it's this year so far.
This is probably every single episode. This is where the industry is just
stick it to the ad industry.
The industry is just so up its own arse. Like there's a grudging ambivalence. To
who
most
are you? What have you done with Esther?
No, Esther has always been quite hot about that.
There is a grudging tolerance of them, and
yeah. It's a necessary.
To the extent that I think most people just, you know, it's like saying, oh, people love road signs. You know, people just kind of acknowledge them as they go past, if they even remember them.
I'm not sure you're right, though.
In terms of what?
Well,
in terms of the subscription
ads
context?
Ads introduce you to stuff either that you knew you needed and were looking for, or that you actually didn't know you needed. You know,
oh, do you know what? Actually, I need to take all of this back because my little girl ended up going to Spot's birthday party because of a very well targeted Instagram ad.
See,
well, but I didn't like it.
The reason that the ads in our newsletter work is because they're very, very targeted ads. They're about things that people that are working in publishing need.
Instagram, they're contextually targeted, though, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that there's ads in the first however many pages of Vogue with Prada stuff is a great thing because it's a work of art in its own weird way.
You can have a mundane ad for a mundane thing that if it pops up in the right way at the right time is good. And I think this is where the industry is like, oh, you know, good ads, bad ads. It's like, no, it's about the whole experience. And if you're landing on a web page and you're just getting absolutely showered with stuff, it doesn't matter how good those ads are, it's not a good experience.
That is
and fear. that's what brings it back to this discussion. Because if you're paying for a subscription product, you don't necessarily expect ads. Therefore, the intrusion of them makes it a bad ad by design. It's and that's what turns people off. Yeah.
Well, no, I think I will just finish with that. And I think this is the thing for subscription publishers and the ad experience is that if, you know, let's take the FT. If you subscribe to the FT and there's an advert in there for, you know, a financial course, let's say at a university, that is a relevant ad that has been targeted at you if, because you're that particular reader. If you log on to the FT and you're just bombarded by like cheap programmatic, that is not a good experience. That's where I think people need to be really, really careful. I loathe programmatic anyway, but would people object to hearing about things that are relevant to them in publications they're subscribed to if they are well-placed and carefully crafted? I don't know.
That's probably nuanced.
But there's some good news within this for publishers anyway. Consumers also said they were less likely to cancel subscriptions to digital publications than they were in 2022, which the report suggests means that they may be spending on subscriptions less cautiously than when fears of a recession were more acute. Peter, that goes back to what you were saying about kind of the cost of living crisis. Ominously, the relatively low proportion of people who pay means that publishers may still struggle to find new people to take up subscriptions. So the quote is, although strong demand from power subscribers remains, the data suggests that publishers could be increasingly reliant on a relatively small total audience for their subscription revenues. That could leave publishers' businesses exposed if this group begins to make deep cuts to their subscription portfolios or simply fails to add new subscriptions quickly enough to offset cancellations.
I mean, I think it's interesting. I Googled this to see what the average percentage of the audience that paid actually was. And it's all over the place. And there's a thing that in this report from Toolkits that talks about different publications that Reuters had done. It might be part of the digital news report, actually. And it varies from 2% through like 7% or whatever. Leaky Paywalls, who has an agenda, they're trying to sell paywalls, says that 10% of the audience should subscribe. And I think, you know, that's optimistic. But
that is super optimistic. Are you kidding me?
Well, for me, the point with that is, even if 90%, even if 10% subscribe, 90% don't. That's a kind of interesting number there. So,
I just think back to that 100-10-1 rule, where it's like 100 people will just kind of lurk, 10% will actively take part, and 1% of people will actually sort of like get involved. Yeah. 10% of people getting subscribing, that's insanity. That's crazy. Yeah.
So the LA Times digital subscribers is 3.82%. I don't know. Philadelphia Inquirer is 1%, 1.2%. Arkansas Democrat Gazette out of Little Rock in Arkansas is a whopping 7.10%.
Just before I ask the two of you whether you are optimistic or, you know, realist about audiences and their propensity to pay for subscriptions, here is something that I found particularly interesting. So the report found that 30% of respondents said they believe content they must pay to access is of higher quality than content that's available for free. And 25% said they have more trust in publications that require a subscription. Both of those stats, to me, seem insanely low, considering that the blitz of kind of like marketing from publications like the Times and Sunday Times over the past 10, 12 years has been, you pay for better content.
That's actually the sort of proportion I would expect to see if you did that survey in the UK, because we have such high quality free news. No offense to the US, just the whole like BBC thing. But I think the Toolkits did point out that there's a bit of a concern in the US that because you pay, because the subscriber model incentivizes publishers to pay, like write content that appeals to their audience, you do end up in a little bit of a loop of, the publication will only write content at an angle or in a way that appeases its subscribers. And that therefore there's maybe not quite that trust loop closing there.
That is a weird number, because who's going to say, yeah, I pay for a subscription for this crappy product. Why would you ever say it? There's a bias in that question.
But does the fact that there is a bias inherent in the question, there's a bias inherent in the system, does that not imply that that figure is actually slightly lower? Because the vast majority of people...
Yeah, I think it seems low. I don't
know. No, I mean that it should be like... That it should be lower. Because the people who are responding to the survey...
No, definitely not. It should be lower. No, you're thinking, I'm paying for stuff. I mean, this isn't tied to an individual brand, right? No. So I'm paying for stuff because it's better. Otherwise, why would I pay for that?
Yeah, so why have 2 in 3 people said, yeah, I don't think it's any better than the free stuff?
That is a weird one.
How do we feel about subscriptions as a revenue model now?
I think that depends who you are, right? Depends what your brand is.
Actually, that's a good point. Just to leap in, sorry, the report does actually make plain that B2B and B2C are very different in this respect. Yeah. And it actually has a really interesting recommendation for B2B publishers, which is that because typically they're enterprise level, don't discount all that much, because you could probably have a better profit margin if you don't discount and just kind of assume that the company's going to pay for it.
Publishing's belief that subscriptions will deliver more revenue is pretty obvious. I think the Reuters news report says it's 80% see it as a priority. But, you know, should you abandon advertising? Maybe if you're Esther, but if you're a sensible, normal person, absolutely not.
Oh my God.
Should you be trying to monetize people who won't subscribe? Yes, there's a great piece in The Audiences from Leonard Schneider, I think it is, who's comes up with like a bunch of different ways that people are not just offering subscriptions, they're doing day passes, season passes.
And none of those involve micropayments, which I was very impressed at.
I know, right?
But do you know what? See, if you dig into it, the tokens or coins aspect of it is kind of like micropayments.
All the challenges involved in tokens and coins are exactly the same challenges as micropayments.
So I think it's all, how often have we said that? It's a mixture, right? It's always going to be a mixture.
I'm on Esther's side on this in terms of the advertising, just so we can go on the record for this one.
Good God in Govan. This week I spoke to the head of ED&I at Immediate Media, Riddhi Radia. We spoke about the importance of leadership teams leading ED&I efforts, how important it is to bring underrepresented groups together within an organisation. But I started by asking her how she came to ED&I following the killing of George Floyd.
How did I come into ED&I? So, yes, originally my background is PR, and I've been in PR in media and publishing for over 10 years, most recently as senior PR manager at Immediate Media. And during lockdown, so throughout my time as a PR manager, I was always aware that I was the only person who looked like me in a room. I remember my first job was at IBC Media, which no longer exists, but I remember my first day and I had a call with my granddad, who lives in India, and he was like, oh, how many Indians work there? And I was like, oh, I never even thought of that. So I was always conscious of it. I was always conscious that if there was someone who looked like me in a room, they were usually the people who were serving us, rather than the people who were on the table with me. And so during lockdown and during the sort of unfortunate death of George Floyd, and how every company and every human being really was looking at their own sort of worlds and self-reflecting, I did the same. Yep. And I remember one night when I sent an email to my chief people officer, Joe Brandel, and said everything that we should be doing and this is everything that's wrong. And I pressed send and then I was like, oh my God, what have I done? I'm going to be fired. And so I didn't sleep that night. And then the next morning, and that's one good thing about Immediate, is when they sort of recognize your passion, they really give you the space and the tools to go and pursue it. And I've been so lucky with my leadership team, and that's exactly what they did for me. And Immediate was always known for a people-first culture, and it still is. And I think they took it very, very seriously, and they self-reflected, and they said, you're completely right. It was always on the list to do, but it always went down. of the priority list. And when something like this happens, I think you have no choice but to do something about it. And they gave me the space and they gave me the chance to take it on as a secondment and the training for it. And they never said no to me. So I've been very lucky. I've always had a yes to any idea and initiative I proposed. So I took it on as a secondment because I didn't want to leave PR because I was so scared of doing something new and taking that risk. But once I did take it on, I never looked back. And I'm here sort of three years later, still doing the work.
Oh, I don't know if this is a fair way of putting this, but what do you think is the biggest change that either that you've led or that you've seen within the business over those 3 years? Because in some ways, 3 years is a long time, right? Mm-hmm. But in other ways, 3 years is nothing. Yeah. In the lifespan of an organization, it's nothing. Yeah.
I think because as a publishing industry, we were quite far behind compared to other industries. So when you're looking at finance or you're looking at sort of commercial or sort of fashion, etc., I think from an ED&I perspective, publishing and media were a little bit behind. And so there were some really quick wins that we could do. So it almost made it look like I did a lot more than I did in that first year because they were quite...
That's very honest of you.
But I think the main change I've seen is the sort of people talking about ED&I in a pub from a media point of view. I was sitting in a pub. I wasn't even on the table and it was, you know, two white men and they were actually talking about inclusion and diversity. And that is something I would never have seen 4 years ago. And if people are taking that conversation out of the workplace and they're learning from each other and they're debating and they're talking about lived experiences, I think that then starts influencing into all the decision making. And that's a huge change. And that's fundamental, I think, to creating change is just sharing and having those uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah, I saw something that you'd written. I can't remember if it was on LinkedIn, but one of the things that you said was you have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yes, it's something I had to do very quickly because, you know, you're talking to people about race and you're talking to people about emotive issues and situations, which are very hard for people to digest and not become defensive, I think, straight away. Yeah. And that's something I would do as well. And also for me, it was hard not to be too emotive and not take it personally either. And I think it's only when you start having that, creating that psychologically safe space in the first place to have those uncomfortable conversations, that is when people start developing trust and developing that empowerment, I think, to inspire and start creating change. And I think even going back to that pub conversation is that sort of overarching change, but really action change is just seeing more people like me in the industry, seeing more people like me in our company, seeing more people talk about neurodiversity and intersectionality, and looking at content and stories have changed. And I think we've come a long way as a media company in the last 3 years. And I think that's I feel very optimistic about the industry when I look at it that way.
So that diverse storytelling, I'm guessing, starts with a diverse staff, right? Mm-hmm. Is that something that you're specifically putting lots of effort into, or is that something that comes from another place?
I think,
how'd you get to that diversity?
It goes hand in hand. I think diverse storytelling and culture, workplace culture and diverse staff goes hand in hand. However, there are times when you don't have that, but you still need to include, you know, make sure that your storytelling is as diverse as it is. And that's where you ensure that your contributors, you ensure that the people you're surrounding yourself with, and that you're, and if we're talking just from an editorial point of view, that you're, so you have a more external network that you can talk to and listen to and actively listen to and learn from. And I think that's, again, where some of the work that companies are doing around sort of training and diverse storytelling and having those, going back to that uncomfortable conversations, all of that plays a part into the way content creators look at how they're creating a piece of content. Because you might go to a lunch and learn around, you know, International Women's Day, for example, and then you might go back to your desk and actually start thinking about what you're doing and creating, hopefully, in a different way.
I mean, I hate metrics, okay? I hold my hand up as one of the spreadsheet impaired. But is there a way that you can measure that kind of thing?
It's really hard to measure, and it's something we talk about internally all the time around sort of content auditing. But it's only, you can only measure visible diversities, I think, gender and race, and sometimes when you're looking at sort of family representation. So you can look at visible diversities, but it's really hard to measure invisible diversities. And I think one of the things is, no matter where you start, you will always be tokenistic. And I think it's when you start doing it the same way over and over and over again is when it starts to become part of your strategy and part of the change. So it's all well and good to, measure content. And I think there are certain people who think in that way, and they need to see change from a stats point of view. And I think completely you can measure sort of representative, visible diversities. But I think until it's ingrained into every single thing you're doing and you're part of your business strategy and part of your editorial strategy, it won't really make a change. You know, same way as when we look at pay gap reporting, we're all measuring it. It was an ask from the government. We've all put commitments in place and we all look at it every year. But that change takes a long time. That's the same thing, I think, with content, is we can start measuring it, but it's what you do with that measurement and what do you put in place for that measurement. That's really important.
And it's not just about content, right? It's about people all throughout the organization feeling comfortable working in the organization. You know, you talked right at the beginning about your lived experience of, you know, not seeing people that looked like you in the organization. So I guess that's part of it, is just seeing the long-term change in terms of who actually is present in the room, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think publishing industry is, it doesn't have the best reputation for hiring diversity. And this is me talking about visible diversities, actually. There's so much nepotism as well within the industry. And I think one of the things that everyone needs to look at is, how are they recruiting? What's the language that we're using? The first change I saw that we made was around showing salaries on our job ads. It's something that the publishing industry doesn't do. And it's something that there's so much research that women and people from ethnic minority backgrounds sell themselves short when there are no salaries being shown on job ads, because people just want to get their foot in the door. And they don't realize that they're actually selling themselves short than what they should be at, because they don't know anyone else in the industry to understand what it is that they should be putting themselves at. And I think the language we use as well, and where we're going to get that recruitment and understanding. So we took out sort of university degrees, and I think that is very old school way of thinking about how we're recruiting within the publishing industry and the creative industries. And I think also looking at neurodiversities and how we're accommodating the way we're interviewing, the way we're talking to people. You know, are we putting people off from certain ways of working? So I think a lot goes into recruitment. And I think recruitment and content goes hand in hand, because these days, if you don't see yourself in the content, you're not going to apply to that company, because, you know, you don't feel like you'll belong there.
She said as an industry that we're not great, publishing is not great, or media in general is not great. Is it getting better? You know, there was this whole, upsurge at the time of George Floyd's murder. Mm-hmm. And then, I'm seeing it from the outside. You can see what mm-hmm. I look like, right? I'm an old white guy. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing it from the outside. But it seems to me that it's gone a lot quieter than it was at the point that you sent that email.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that fair?
I think there's two things to that. I think there's a little bit of fatigue around ED&I. Mm-hmm. I think when you don't see change happen quickly, I think people from diverse backgrounds anyway, stop showing up and get a bit fed up. And I think there's a bit of fatigue. And there's a bit of fatigue in the sense of some of the work is placed on diverse people to do the work rather than the people that who should be doing the work in terms of leadership, etc. So a little bit of fatigue in that sense. And I think the second is, I do think there's a lot of work happening. I've seen a huge change within the industry in the last 3 years, just in terms of I feel like I'm being listened to from all corners, not just internally, but externally. I think there are, you know, our industry bodies like IAB and PPA and AOP are doing a lot of, Advertising Association as well, are doing a lot of work around it. I think there's lots of ED&I steering groups and ED&I being talked about in boardrooms, which wouldn't have happened, you know, in 2019. There's a theme that I use within our company because that helps me sort of shape on where I am and where I think the organization is in the ED&I sort of curve. And I always say, so in 2019, I said that we were unaware. So, you know, fair to say that I think industry was unaware, organization was unaware, leadership were unaware. And then 2020, I use the word sort of emerging. So like basic data, policies are being developed and sort of HR is responsible, but it's ED&I is emerging. And I think 2021 and 2022 is when people started looking at it as a strategic priority, especially within immediate, you know, and it wasn't just sort of an HR responsibility. In fact, all leaders started owning ED&I and it became part of the overall strategy. And then 23 for us anyway, was all about sort of ED&I as part of everything we do. So that we started, you know, leaders were sort of committed, policies and practices and initiatives were reflected and, you know, reinforced. And I think for me this year and sort of beyond is really starting to get a bit disruptive. So last year could have felt quiet because I do think a lot of people were in that strategic stage. And I do think this year people are starting to look at, especially internally, and a lot of other people I've been speaking to and just around the industry, is how do we start disrupting and leveraging difference, leveraging ED&I to create business value?
You know, as I say, I tend to see this, we tend to see everything from the outside because we're just commentating or we're interviewing people or whatever. You're right inside an organization and you're trying to make this change happen. And it's really interesting to hear you explain these stages in the sense of, well, maybe it did seem a bit quiet because we were doing all this work in the background. But that idea of, you know, the value and leveraging it, have you got answers to those questions?
So we brought all of this diversity in. We've done a lot of work. We've increased our diversity within immediate, but not at the senior level from a visible diversity point of view. How are we ensuring that our people are being developed and that they have the right, our managers have the right tools and skills to manage diverse teams and there's no biases? And how do we make sure that diverse people are getting the right coaching and mentoring and right development skills in place? So I think that's one of the streams. I think one is around audience growth and talent and content. And that piece that I was talking about, future-proofing your brand, we actually did a connection day last day, a connection day in our company is around sort of, we try and bring people together around a theme and we try and do sort of learnings and talks and panels around it to really get people to think in different ways. And one of the talks around our connection day last week was around future-proofing your brand for 2030. And so that was Creative Equals coming in and sharing what audiences and demographics are going to look like in 2030 along with their spending power. So I think that's one of the streams. And then there's a big stream around sort of future talent and future generations. How are we bringing talent in into the industry? And what does a content creator in 2024 look like? You know, do they have, you know, is it social? Is it video? Is it podcast? Is it print? Is it everything? And how do we use some of the learnings and some of the expertise we have within our organization to really mentor and teach those skills to our future generations and bring them into the industry.
What's really interesting about what you're saying is that if we weren't talking about ED&I, if we were talking about, say, digital transformation, and I said, someone, what's the three main things that you need to think about? They would say management, markets, and talent. Yeah. And that's exactly what you've just said about ED&I.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the only way you can make change in ED&I is making sure that inclusion is a leadership and strategic priority, and really designing your strategy around your transformation business strategy. That's the only way it will go hand in hand. And that's the way you get buy-in as well. And I think, yes, HR and people team and myself, we all have a role to sort of drive these initiatives and implement them and create them. But it's only when it becomes central to your business strategy and when it becomes sort of a leadership priority that an accountability becomes a key, that's when you start moving the dial. And I think we're getting there. I think when we don't put ED&I into CSR or HR, and we put it as a foundation, and it's sort of an agenda point during board meetings. It's talked about at leadership level, and it's really embedded into the teams. And I think that is the only way that we can achieve sort of meaningful change.
Immediate is a big company. Immediate was able to say to you, okay, well, put your money where your mouth is and come and do this job. They could support you in that. Not every organization can do that. And I guess one of the things I'm aware of, I remember talking to Sharish Kulkarni at Media Cymru about this, that idea that we'll hire an intern who happens to be, whatever, a person of color or a person, disabled or particular genders or whatever it is, whatever that issue is, needs to be addressed is, and we'll make the intern responsible for that. And his point was, that's absolute bullshit. Mm-hmm. There's no way it's a management issue. So what advice would you be giving smaller publishers that maybe don't have the resources that Immediate has to move ED&I forward?
I have been asked this a few times, and my answer is always data, which is what I'm guessing you were expecting me to say. And I always say data is people's best friend. But I also think it needs to come from the top. It has to come from the board and the leadership. And they need to understand what ED&I is in the first place and what their role within ED&I is.
The idea of belonging, I think, is brilliant. The idea that if you feel like you belong to an organization, then from an employer's point of view, those are the people that will take that organization forward. Almost just like building these communities inside a community, and then that all comes together.
Yeah, I think network groups are so important, because when you go to collect the data, whether that's quantitative or qualitative, if you haven't got that safe space, you will never get the truth. And network groups help create that safe space to get to the truth of how people are feeling. And I think that's why they're so important, because they create that community and that support for people who might not feel like they belong within a company, or they might not feel psychologically safe when they enter the company. But by joining the group, it helps them feel like they belong, and they feel psychologically safe to then tell us the real truth behind what's going on. And I think belonging, and that's one of the things that I really loved about Immediate, and it's my longest job ever, is because they really believe that if people are happy and if people feel like they belong within a company, the revenues will follow. If you get that right, everything else will follow, and you will get the buy-in from your people. And that, I mean, that is something that came from our chairman Tom and our chief people officer Joe. It was their sort of ethos when they built Immediate, and that's really stuck, and everything we do is around that sort of ethos. But I think network groups is really, really important. I think it's also important to make sure that you are evolving and communicating with those network groups, because it's all well and good setting them up. But if they're not part of the change, if they don't have a say in your policies, if they don't have a say in, you know, even like, so every company is trying to figure out hybrid working. We're trying to figure out hybrid working. But we try and bring our network groups into those conversations. Those decisions aren't just made by the leadership team. They are listened to. We go out there, we ask the questions, we then report back, and the leadership team take all of it on board before making a decision. Same with policies, same with so any integral decision that affects the culture of the company is reviewed by the network groups. And then they feel like they're part of the journey, and that's the only way you'll get it right.
Okay, here's my last question for you. Mm-hmm. So your background's in PR.
Yes.
If you had to go out and do the PR for immediate efforts in ED&I, what would your headline be? What would you lead on?
Oh, God, this is me doing it. This is me on this podcast. very good question. I don't know. I think my PR background has helped me a lot, actually, in influencing ED&I internally and storytelling, because I think you have to share your stories and be transparent. What would the headline be? It would have to be something around leadership, I think. When I talk to my peers in the industry around ED&I, I find I'm very lucky, I think, in having my leadership giving me a yes all the time. I haven't had to sort of, I've obviously, you know, like all other case departments and people, you go there and you show your proposals and you show your budgets and you show your strategy, but I haven't had hard pushes, which I know goes on in the industry, and I think that is because the leadership team sees it as a strategic priority. It is part of their KPIs. It's part of the business.
That wasn't a fair question, but I had to ask it. Ruddy, thank you so much. This has been brilliant. So in case you've forgotten, because, well, I don't know, there's been a week since we talked about that, we have a daily newsletter where we share the most important three... No. Where we share... the most important three stories and then some bullshit that we dig up.
And then the fourth that we grab because we're desperate for a fourth feature.
No, seriously, it is four. I promise you, I count it. Just the top four you need to know to impress your boss and all your other colleagues. You will be absolutely up to date on what's important in the media, and you can go out and show off in the office.
Talking of newsletters, if you're listening on Monday, entries are open today for the Publisher Newsletter Awards. It's our second year of doing it. You can go to publishernewsletters.com to enter. It's the same smooth system we've got as our podcast awards, so you can log in, you can start your draft, you can kind of just have a mooch around the categories you might want. Entries open for that, and they close sort of mid-May, so get on it, publishernewsletters.com.
It's a smooth experience.
Smooth operator.
But for now, until we launch the Media Voices musical, which is coming towards the end of this year, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another fantastic guest and a tour through everything that's important in media. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye.